golden age of radio. Radio drama, it's a wonderful thing, exercises the imagination, and we don't hear nearly enough of it. But God bless him, Anthony Sloan back in town, NOLO Radio, special production, I can hardly wait. I support, Uprising of the Downtrodden.
Thursday, September 17th, 7 p.m.
My name is Celia de la Varenne, and I'm the founder and the president of Stop Trafficking of People. Did you know that throughout the world there are 8 million of new victims of sex trade per year? This is what is happening right now in Haiti. This is why Stop needs your help to open a rescue center in Haiti. On September 18th, Alexia Klein, a fashion designer, will host a fundraising event to help Stop to reach that goal. The event will take place in the Fashion District at Au Marché, the Globe Showroom, located 263 West, 38th Street. It's on the 11th floor, and we will be waiting for you from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Our website, stoptraffickingofpeople.org.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. Enjoy.
Stars fill my dream. I sun. There's a ground in my eye, you would say, as I scale this racing line,
Was Free Mumia by Hardicle Crew. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer. Today we're discussing the growing epidemic of hepatitis C throughout the country as a whole, and in particular, our focus will be the prison system. And we're going to not only look at the systemic denial of care that's going on in state after state, but also look at the cases of two political prisoners in this country who have hepatitis C and the struggles that they have had to get properly treated. In one case, just recently with a victory in which he's finally being treated, and that's Robert Seth Hayes, and the other one, Mumia Abu-Jamal, he is still struggling to get the treatment that is absolutely the standard of care that has been denied him for quite a while. As background, let me read from an article just published on August 24th on the website thebody.com by Victoria Law. Do jail and prison authorities have the right to deny prisoners life-saving medical care simply because of the price tag? People imprisoned in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Minnesota are heading to court to find out, with suits focused on access to expensive treatment that can cure hepatitis C. Hepatitis C treatment remains extremely rare, despite high rates of infection among prisoners. In early August, attorneys for 61-year-old political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, incarcerated in Pennsylvania, filed a lawsuit challenging the prison authority's denial of medical care, including treatment for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a liver disease caused by the hepatitis C virus, or HCV, that can cause lasting health damage and death. Although 15 to 25% of people infected have immune systems that can clear the virus, the other 75 to 85% become chronically infected, meaning that the virus evades their immune system's response. And 60 to 70% of these affected will develop chronic liver disease. 5 to 20% will develop cirrhosis, and 1 to 5% will die from liver cancer or cirrhosis caused by HCV. However, unless tested, people may not even know that they are infected. Symptoms often take 20 to 30 years to appear. Until recently, HCV treatment consisted of injection-based interferon, which has side effects including flu-like symptoms, depression, and chronic fatigue. It also has a low success rate. But in late 2013, the Food and Drug Administration approved cimeprevir and sofosbuvir, which shortened treatment to 12 weeks, eliminate side effects, and clear the virus in 90 to 95% of people. The American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases recommends treatment for all people with chronic hepatitis C infections, except those with a life expectancy of less than a year. But drug companies charge between $60,000 and $80,000 for a 12-week regimen. The CDC estimates that 1 in 3 of the 2.2 million people in U.S. jails and prisons have hepatitis C, a much higher rate than the 1 to 1.5% infected outside of prison. And again, that's from the article by Victoria Law on the website thebody.com. And we are joined now on the phone by Victoria Law. She's a freelance writer and editor. Her work focuses on the intersections of incarceration, gender, and resistance. And she's the author of the book Resistance Behind Bars: The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. Victoria, thank you very much for joining us on Health Action.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this.
So lay out for us in a little more detail, what is this pattern of refusal to treat hepatitis C that's going on at jails and prisons around the country?
When we look at the refusal to treat hepatitis C in jails and prisons, we have to tie it into poor, inadequate, and sometimes life-threatening medical care or lack of medical care in jails and prisons across the country. People in jails and prisons actually have a constitutional right to medical care. However, what they have a right to and what is actually practiced are vastly different. So even before these new drugs that are vastly more expensive than the previous treatments became available, people weren't necessarily getting treated. Most jails and prisons don't routinely test people for hepatitis C. If they do, they may not tell them that they have the hepatitis virus. And in a lot of jails and prison systems, they don't actually want to give treatment because this costs money, it costs time, and it's just all around not a priority, just as treating people for any other medical or health issue behind bars has not been a priority.
Besides the long-term and institutional denial of adequate medical care in general, this is exacerbated by the exorbitant price charged by these drug company monopolies. So talk to us about how this is being used as kind of the latest excuse for prisons and jails not providing what is the official standard of care for people incarcerated who have this virus.
Well, the price tag is certainly an issue. So when the issue has come up about how many people in jail and prison have hepatitis C, we're not seeing sheriffs and prison administrators often push back, and they point to the high price tag of these drugs. And they point out that treating even the small fraction of people that they know have hepatitis then basically breaks their budget for healthcare. But people imprisoned in Minnesota, in Pennsylvania, and in Massachusetts have actually gone to court to file and challenge this denial of healthcare.
Speaking of court cases, one of the latest lawsuits to be filed on this issue is by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with his case, the internationally renowned journalist who was convicted of the murder of a police officer in Philadelphia in 1982, despite overwhelming evidence of his innocence, and had been on death row up until a few years ago when the intense worldwide campaign on his behalf, together with some litigation, managed to overturn the death sentence and change his sentence to life without parole. So many of our listeners may have heard about Mumia's health problems that really first came to light on March 30th of this year when he was rushed to the emergency room unconscious with what later was revealed to be diabetic shock. But there had been earlier signs of trouble. And let me read from the lawsuit that Mumia filed in the first week of August against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections for their denial of hepatitis C treatment to him, because this may come as news to many of our listeners that Mumia has hepatitis C. And in that suit, the papers state that in or about August 2014, Mr. Abu-Jamal began to experience itching over his whole body. The itching was reported to facility staff. Creams were prescribed, but they had no effect. The rash spread. And then in Mumia's own affidavit, as part of this lawsuit, he says, I felt as if my skin was on fire. Indeed, to term the feeling an itch is to minimize it. I was in severe pain. By early 2015, the rash covered most of my body. The skin also became scaly, constantly peeling off various areas of my body. It had the texture of sand. I got little sleep due to the pain, and due to the resultant fatigue, could not concentrate. I lost a significant amount of weight, and my lower extremities became swollen. I was prescribed prednisone, an oral steroid, cyclosporine, antibiotics, Benadryl, and other medications. None offered any relief. What I did not know was that my blood glucose level, which had always been within normal range, began to skyrocket, and he only learned later exactly how high that had become. So we now know from the release of medical records, which had to be fought for, that in fact, on March 6th, which is more than 3 weeks before he was hospitalized, blood was drawn, and it showed that his glucose level had risen to the severely abnormal level of 419, and that the prison medical authorities were aware of this, that it was a dangerous case of hyperglycemia, elevated blood sugar, but that they took no action to address this, and they did not even inform Mumia of that test result. And the result is that hospitalization, which he almost died. So I now want to bring forward Dr. Suzanne Ross, a longtime political activist and supporter of Mumia and active with the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition, and someone who has frequently visited Mumia in prison and worked night and day to obtain his release from his unjust conviction. Suzanne, thanks for joining us on Health Action.
Good to be on.
I wanted to talk about what really we're now understanding in retrospect as a medical mystery at the time of his hospitalization on March 30th, that no one really understood. Where did this extreme life-threatening diabetes come from? It seemed to pop out of nowhere. And what did it have to do with this intense skin pain that he was suffering? And nobody had a clue that it had anything to do with hepatitis C. So talk to us about, I mean, you were there at the time, you were active in holding press conferences and organizing the international pressure campaign that finally led to some beginning steps towards proper care. Talk to us about what was going on at the time, what people thought, and where you think this is coming from in terms of the long-term pattern of the treatment of Mumia.
I remember how all of us felt back then, especially when Mumia was rushed to the hospital, how frightened we were and how much we felt that his life was literally in danger, that he could die at that time. Mumia has said many times, and many of us are convinced that it's absolutely true, that he would not be alive today had it not been for the international movement. The fact that by the time Mumia got to the hospital where he was rushed, his family, several activists, Brett, the attorney who's on the phone with us, were all at the hospital, and that we held a press conference the following morning, not to mention the many actions we took at the prison itself, at the Department of Corrections, and ultimately at the governor's mansion and governor's office in the Rotunda in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and the thousands and thousands of emails, phone calls, and faxes that were sent to the Department of Corrections, to the prison, and to the governor, that's what saved Mumia's life, because at that moment, they were going to let him die. I'm convinced they were going to let him die. He was that sick in the hospital. When his family, when it was allowed in for a half hour each, his wife, Wadia, and his brother, Keith, they looked beyond crestfallen. They looked like they had just seen their beloved brother and husband on the verge of death. And had we not been there, had we not been screaming and yelling and demanding immediate care and that Mumia's life be recognized as precious, he would not be with us today. And Mumia, as I said, has said this many times, and the thank you message that he sent out to the movement is a very heartfelt one and very moving. For those of you listeners who may not have heard it, you can go to prisonradio.com and listen to it, because it is worth hearing how much he appreciated, because it's an inspiration and a reminder to us all what we need to continue. So we never knew how sick Mumia was until really early February. In February, I got a letter from Mumia detailing kind of a diary of everything that he had been experiencing that whole month, with the itching and the growing weakness and all the symptoms he was experiencing. We knew he had hep C back in 2012 when he was tested, given routine blood tests when he was taken out of death row and transferred to general population. But we did not understand. First of all, Maria was not told that this was serious. And in addition to that, we didn't know what we now know, because at that time he didn't have these skin problems, and we didn't have a doctor from the outside consult on the significance of this. But that was the beginning. And when he got so sick, with initially with the skin itching and the pain in his skin, and then they gave him steroids to treat the skin, and apparently the assessment was later that some of those steroids really led to the rise in his blood sugar level. Now we also have the report from Dr. Joseph Harris, who's been really incredible in his formulations and in the breakthrough he's made in formulating at least a tentative diagnosis, which to this day the Department of Corrections has never given. The Department of Corrections has been so negligent and incompetent and malevolent that not only did it not treat Mumia, but it never came up with a diagnosis. And now that we have a tentative one through Dr. Harris's research, which was very, very impressive, because it was not the standard assessment, just, you know, he went outside the box. He was researching studies that were done in Egypt. He was researching particular hepatitis C and skin problems in black people. So he did not just look at it in a mechanical way. And when he assessed and the overall picture, the overall medical picture, and said that the hepatitis C was fundamentally responsible for everything, including the diabetic picture that emerged, that too can be caused by hepatitis C, and that there were cases, numerous cases, particularly among black men, and that, you know, and that's why they found this in Egypt, of the coming together of these skin problems with the hepatitis C, and the particular picture of the skin problem that Mumia manifests itself, apparent from his research, does not appear anywhere unless there's a condition of hepatitis C. So the hepatitis C workup that was demanded by the attorneys, and Mumia ultimately got, at least not a full one yet, but the hepatitis C picture that we now have definitely calls for immediate treatment for that. And that there are additional treatments that can deal with the skin discomfort. Ironically, they're refusing to even give that. One of the items that could make a difference in terms of the itching is zinc, which you can get in any drugstore. And they're refusing to give him that, even though that might very well alleviate some of the symptoms, but it would not get at the fundamental problem. According to Dr. Harris, the hepatitis C treatment, this expensive drug that is a miracle drug of these last few years, apparently, according to all assessments I've heard from so many doctors, so many sources, this drug, within 8 to 12 weeks, can cure the symptoms so that the virus, the hepatitis C virus, no longer shows up in the blood. That's what we mean by cure. And that is what we're demanding. That's what we will keep demanding until we get it. That's what the campaign is. We're going to start a campaign. I mean, we've been asking for medical treatment, of course, and diagnosis, and now, so we've been asking for all this all along. But I think this is the time now to be very specific. Now that the legal papers have been filed, the legal papers demand immediate treatment for the hepatitis C. The additional two, the giving Mumia the zinc supplement and the topical agent called Protopic, both of which will alleviate the symptoms but not cure them. And finally, that Mumia finally be allowed to be examined by his own doctor. And the doctor that I refer to, Dr. Joseph Harris, was not allowed to examine him privately. He saw him in the visiting room like the rest of us when we visit him, and he just eyeballed him and carefully and did the research and put together a tentative diagnosis. But a direct examination is essential. The Department of Corrections should be indicted for its failure, one, to take seriously the hepatitis C, two, to not tell Mumia, his family, his lawyers, or anybody when his sugar level was so dangerously high, and so that nobody even knew about it. They had tested him and knew that on March 6th. The actual crisis where he fell into a coma, he was not in a coma. He was in diabetic shock. We should really be exactly precise. So the diabetic shock that he was in was on March 30th. So this almost 3 weeks later, only because he fainted and nearly died, that we found out that he had a diabetic condition. I mean, that is beyond outrageous.
So, speaking of the need to indict the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, in Mumia's lawsuit against them, it stated that during the last week of July 2015, Mr. Abu-Jamal was informed by a doctor at SCI Mahanoy that a blood test revealed that he has active hepatitis C. So again, just to clarify for everyone, he had the test in 2012 that showed he had hepatitis C antibody, but the next step in the medical protocol is always to then see whether the virus is actually active, because as we mentioned at the outset, you can have the virus and have no symptoms and no problems for many years, but you want to determine whether it's active, whether there's what's called a viral load, which is a reproduction of virus going on. That was not done in 2012, and it wasn't done until pressure was brought in 2015, in July of this year. Now, here's the most stunning line in the legal papers. Mr. Abu-Jamal was informed that the DOC currently has no protocol for treating hepatitis C. Despite Mr. Abu-Jamal having active hepatitis C that has been causing him severe health problems for several months, the defendants are refusing to provide him with hepatitis C treatment. And indeed, Mumia is not alone in suing the department. In June, three other incarcerated people in Pennsylvania sued the department, saying that the DOC, by policy and practice, systematically denies necessary medical care for inmates diagnosed with hepatitis C viral infections, thereby placing them at substantial and unnecessary risk for severe illness, injury, and death. And joining us now on the phone is one of Mumia's two attorneys, the other one being Bob Boyle, but with us on this discussion is Brett Grody, who is counsel with the Abolitionist Law Center in Pittsburgh. Thank you, Brett, for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay, so tell us about the legal basis and just overall, what are the charges made in Mumia's lawsuit for which you are one of the two counsel?
There's a series of legal claims, both constitutional and state medical malpractice claims, and the issues are that they have been deliberately indifferent to his hyperglycemia and his new-onset diabetes in March, resulting in the near-death experience that Suzanne was talking about, him going into diabetic shock. There is deliberate indifference and medical neglect of his hepatitis C, which they've been providing absolutely no treatment for. And there's also a claim that they're not treating his skin condition any longer. as Suzanne indicated, in the past, he had this rash that was pruritic. It was itching all over his body. It still is. It was leading to painful scaling of his skin, at times affecting more than 70% of his body. And the treatments that they were giving to him were having adverse effects. So there's some thinking amongst the medical experts we've consulted with that it was the injection of steroids that helped precipitate the new onset diabetes. It is also the case that active hepatitis C can precipitate new onset diabetes. So you have these factors both present in Mumia. And they were also providing him with medications that he ended up developing allergies to. So in May, they provided him with, they prescribed him Protopic, which is a topical agent. And at the time, upon recommendation from one of his consulting physicians, Mumia said he wanted to delay application of the Protopic because it was contraindicated for use on malignant skin. And there was concern that he might have cancer, and there was testing ongoing, and they did not have the results. Well, since tests have come back ruling out cancer of the skin, the Department of Corrections has inexplicably refused to reinstate the prescription for Protopic, which was something they themselves had prescribed earlier. So those are the medical care claims that we're raising. And one of the reasons that we're raising state medical neglect claims as well is because when the United States Supreme Court in 1976, in the case of Estelle v. Gamble, held that prisoners have a right to medical care, they simultaneously held that medical neglect is not unconstitutional. And in order for somebody who's incarcerated to prevail on a cruel and unusual punishment claim for denial of medical care, they had to show that defendants were deliberately indifferent, which is a legal term which has a higher standard of subjective intent or awareness of the risks and harm than medical neglect. And when you read through the case law filed by people who are incarcerated, case after case of wretched, deplorable, appalling medical conduct by prison medical staff is frequently thrown out of court on the basis of some prison doctor or physician's assistant saying it was my medical opinion that if this was an adequate course of treatment for the symptoms that were displayed, and the court will say we're not going to interfere with differences over medical judgments. You know, you can bring a state medical neglect claim, but this isn't cruel and unusual punishment. So the United States Supreme Court has held that medical neglect is constitutionally acceptable, so that's why we're bringing the state and the federal claims. We just moved through a preliminary injunction last week, which is a request that the court grant us relief so that Mumia can get the new direct-acting antiviral medications for his hepatitis C, along with the zinc and the Protopic. As Suzanne said, the zinc is something that any one of us can go out and get from a GNC. So their refusal to provide this is again mind-boggling. Actually, giving him the zinc, one of the reasons for doing this is because of the recommendation from Dr. Joseph Harris, who we've been working with because of the movement, and Suzanne in particular had a relationship with him and introduced us to him. He has identified this condition, necrolytic acral erythema, which is primarily found in black patients who are hepatitis C positive, and it involves a rash similar to Mumia's, which has been quite severe, and treatment doctor after, you know, medical staff said they've never seen anything like it. And it's caused in part by zinc dysregulation. So by providing him zinc, that can provide some measure of relief for the skin condition, and it also can provide diagnostic confirmation that this is in fact necrolytic acral erythema, which renders it, you know, all the more certain that the skin condition he's been experiencing for a year now is being caused by active hepatitis C, along with an array of other health problems. Like I said, the new onset diabetes. He has anemia of chronic disease, and the only chronic disease that he had is active hepatitis C. He's had conditions like edema, fatigue. His skin has broken out in lesions. And the Department of Corrections has apparently no protocol for treating hepatitis C right now. This is what Mumia was told by a physician's assistant at the prison in around June. He was, you know, at Mumia was asking about the hepatitis C treatment, and he was told by physician's assistant Saxon, that they don't have a protocol right now for these new medications. They say they're working on it, and every time medical staff calls down to central office to ask where it is, they're essentially told, stop asking, you'll get it when you get it. So they're not providing the old forms of treatment, the interferon and ribavirin, and under the old treatments, the standard of care for those who are hepatitis C positive was different. Because the cure rates were so low and the side effects, it was unlikely to cure you, but it was almost certain to lead to debilitating side effects and injure you in some respects. So there was a wait-and-see approach. If somebody doesn't have active hepatitis C, if they're not symptomatic, then they were not to be provided treatment, but to be monitored in the event that it became active. Now, because these new medications do not have those side effects, they have such high cure rates, the standard of care is that everybody who is hepatitis C positive, regardless of whether they are symptomatic, should be treated. And the problem facing prisons and jails is that they are not constitutionally allowed to deny medical care for non-medical reasons. Cost is a non-medical reason, and they are also home to a disproportionate number of those people who are infected with hepatitis C, such that the estimates in the lawsuits filed, the class action suit filed in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, are that approximately 20% of those held captive in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections are hepatitis C positive. So that's more than 10,000 people. You start doing the math on that, you're getting easily and quickly over $500 million, $750 million, and it would bankrupt their budgets. So right now the Department of Corrections is uncertain of how to proceed, and they have again and again shown an absolute red willingness to have all costs and risks borne by those who are incarcerated in their care, and they're demonstrating a remarkable callousness and incompetence in this manner.
Well, let me also bring in another dimension to this issue. When we're dealing with political prisoners in the U.S., and both Mumia Abu-Jamal and the prisoner we're going to talk about in a few minutes, Robert Seth Hayes, are former Black Panthers who were deemed by the FBI at the height of their activism to be the number one security threat to the U.S. And so there has been a pattern of mistreatment of those people railroaded into prison ever since. And we're now joined on the line by Ramona Africa, who is a longtime leader of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia, who herself, she and her entire family were subjected to an actual bomb dropped on their house in 1985 that resulted in the deaths of 11 people, including 6 children. And Ramona escaped with severe burns, but was then railroaded to prison and served 7 years on a false charge of riot. Ramona, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob, and I've been chafing at the bit here because some of the things that I'm hearing just really make my blood boil. Suzanne gave a very detailed accounting of what's happening with Mumia, and in terms of the legal fight, civil, legality is one thing, but they should be charged with attempted murder, because that's what they're doing. They're attempting to murder Mumia. And they may have a measure of incompetence. There may be a measure of neglect. But what they are doing to Mumia and Seth Hayes and, you know, who knows how many other prisoners across this country is deliberate, because when you start talking about how much this pharmaceutical costs, what does money have to do with somebody's life? When these people took these prisoners into custody, they took responsibility for them. And if they are using any excuse to not treat them when they're sick, deliberately make decisions not to treat them with available medication, available treatment, That's attempted murder. Mumia could have died. I know how many prisoners have, in fact, died because decisions were deliberately made. Not neglect, not confusion, deliberately made not to treat them. And these prisoners died. We have to look at this stuff for exactly what it is. Note of what Brett was saying about the court saying, you know, that this was okay, that it was not unconstitutional to withhold treatment basic from inmates. I mean, how dare they? And how can anybody accept that? I mean, I remember when Mumia was in a post-conviction hearing in front of Judge Pamela Denby, and it was addressing a confession made by a man named Arnold Beverly. And what Judge Pamela Denby said was that it wasn't credible. It wasn't timely. You know, it was too late. And they just throw these asinine statements out there. Mumia was still alive. This man issued a confession. How can it be too late to get to the truth? I mean, these people just, okay, the U.S. Supreme Court said that in the case of Herrera versus Texas, that at the point that all appeals had been exhausted, you know, that evidence of innocence is not the issue. Innocence is not the issue. And they executed that man. I mean, how long can people sit back hearing these outrageous, asinine statements and rulings from the court, from this system, and accept it? And accept it without, I mean, really coming at these people about it.
I wanted to specifically ask you to talk about two of the previous cases that take this beyond the realm of theory as to the government being out to kill political prisoners, but actual cases that raise serious suspicions about what happened. And I'm speaking of two members of your organization, the MOVE organization, Merle Africa, who died at the age of 40 of supposedly of cancer in 1998 while doing she was one of what's called the MOVE 9, which is a case that Mumia reported extensively on before his incarceration and some believe led to his incarceration because of his fearless exposure of the police misconduct and systematic attack on MOVE that led to 9 members of the organization being charged with killing a cop when the evidence is clear that it was friendly fire, so-called, from the police side that killed that cop. But in any case, Merle was doing a life sentence, and also then Phil Africa, another one of the MOVE 9, died in January of this year at the age of 59 from unspecified natural causes. So talk a little about what it means that they died in prison under the circumstances that they did.
Let me address the issue of Merle first. They gave, at different times, different reasons for Merle's death, different causes of her death. They initially said natural causes, and when we demanded more details, like what does natural causes mean? What exactly did she die from? Then they said, well, we think that she had some kind of blood clot that traveled from her leg up to her lungs. They said that's what killed her. Then they said, well, we think she had ovarian cancer, and that's what killed her. I mean, they just said all these different things, and we know, I mean, we may not be able to prove it, but we know they did something to Merle. She had some stomach cramps, and they made her take what's called a lay-in. meaning that you are confined to your cell. You don't go to any classes you might be enrolled in. You don't go to anything outside your cell. And they bring you your meals on trays. They bring it to your cell. Laura did not want that. She said she did not feel bad like that. You know, she wanted to go to her job and do the things that, you know, she did daily. They would not allow it. She got a tray, a dinner tray, on this particular day. And that night, her roommate, our sister Debbie Africa, said she heard Merle get up to go to the bathroom, but she did not hear her come back. So she got up to check on Merle, and Merle had passed out. They called an ambulance after Debbie notified the guards. They called an ambulance that they claim takes like 10 minutes to get there. Took them like 45 minutes. When they took Merle out, the next news that our family got was that she had died. That she had died. We know they did something to her. And even though we can't prove it in definitive terms, our position is very simple. When they took custody of Merle, they took responsibility for Merle. And the same applies to anybody that they take into custody. They are then responsible for them. So anything that happens to them, it's their responsibility. And that's how we look at it. Merle was not home, living the life she chose, eating the food that she chose to eat, doing the things that she chose to do. She was in a position where this system, those prison officials, dictated what she did, what she ate, you know, all of that. In terms of Phil had gotten sick about a year ago, and they took him out to the hospital, and it took him a little while to get, you know, his strength back and everything, but he did. He was running, exercising. He was fine. In fact, the day that they took Phil out to the hospital in January, family members had gone up to see him, and he was exercising, doing stretches, talking to people, and when our family, you know, went to visit him, they wouldn't let them have a visit with him. They would not let them visit Phil. They took him out to the hospital then. I mean, there was nothing wrong with Phil at that point, but they took him out to the hospital. And from that point, Phil went downhill. Now, how do you be fine and exercising and talking to people and go into a hospital where they are supposed to be making you better, where they have doctors and all kinds of treatments and all kinds of medication and everything to treat people that have health problems? They take Phil to the hospital, and he gets so bad that they say he needs hospice care, which means that you're on the verge of dying. They sent him back to the prison, and within, 2 days, he died. He just died. And they said the same thing about him. He died of natural causes. What exactly does that mean? You know, what does natural causes mean? He didn't just go to sleep and not wake up.
Absolutely.
That's not what happened to him.
Right.
So, you know, when you have family members, loved ones in these prisons, You have to be on top of everything. And even when you are, because they are in the hands of this system, and that these officials, these prison officials, can do anything, can give them anything without them even knowing it. It's a dangerous, dangerous situation. And that's why we're working so hard to bring our family home.
Right.
And people need to feel justified and feel strong and confident in fighting for their family members, because those running this system trick people into believing that their aim is justice, you know, is to protect people, you know, and to stop crime. Bull. That is bull. Because they have my family in prison, calling them murderers. They got Mumia in prison, calling him a murderer. But meanwhile, the people that are calling our family members murderers dropped the bomb and burned Wu's babies alive. But none of them are sitting in prison for the accusation of murder, for the real, you know, fact that they did murder 11 people. Cops are going around running rampant in these streets, killing people at will. Are they sitting in prison charged with murder or on death row or sitting in prison for 30 to 100 years? No. But they want to call other people murderers? You know, people have to start confronting these people.
And on that note, I'm very sorry, Ramona, but we're running out of time. Let me just give Suzanne Ross of the Free Mumia Abu Jamal Coalition the last word to quickly tell us about upcoming activities in order to take on the challenge that Ramona has just given for us to stay strong in fighting for the rights of our political prisoners to be given the medical care they deserve.
I'm so glad that Ramona brought that whole dimension of murder into the discussion. It is essential that we keep that in mind, and only someone whom they actually tried to murder would feel it the way she does. In terms of the work that we will be doing, one is we're going to have a campaign, of course, to call both the Department of Corrections of Pennsylvania and the governor, who ultimately can not only define that they give Mumia the treatment he needs, but can also release him, which is ultimately what we need. The only time he's going to get the kind of treatment he needs is when he's released. So we're urging people to call the Department of Corrections, 717-728-4109. Call 717-728-4109. That's John Wetzel, is the Department of Corrections Secretary. Demand that Mumia gets the treatment that the doctors are recommending immediately. And two, call Governor Tom Wolf, 717-787-2500, 717-787-2500, and in his case, demand not only that Mumia get the treatment he needs, but that he be released. Ultimately, it is going to be Tom Wolf who has the power to release him. For more information and emails for these individuals and their offices, go to freemumia.com. Our website, that's the International Concerned Family and Friends and Free Mumia Coalition website. And also you can call if you have any questions.